Hello, everyone. This is Dark Journalist. Today, I have a special bonus episode for you with Oxford scholar and Giza Death Star book series author, Dr. Joseph Farrell. Now, Dr. Farrell will take an in-depth look at how the deep state has attempted to appropriate ancient systems of power, understanding, and occult initiation to create an ultimate rule by sorcery. He explores the cultures that left behind the sacred record of advanced technology and the implications of these sacred mystery rites falling into the wrong hands.
If you're the national security state, you're going to do, in my opinion, a deep dive into those ancient texts and try to decode them. You have these civilizations telling you, no, we got this from somebody. And in the case of Babylonia, that somebody came down here, you know, lowered kingship from heaven to earth.
Please join us now.
I mean, if you look at some of these devices, Daniel, they're just bizarre.
They
look like modernist sculptures. You know, they're just bizarre looking things.
Wow. That's incredible. And it reminds me of these objects that, you know, there's a whole group of Laplanders who's used these very mm-hmm. strange objects for healing mm-hmm. or for, you know, improving somebody's mental output or whatever mm-hmm. it is. And they're just odd little things. It's like yeah. weird shape. But what's interesting to me about this is in this period, actually, you mentioned in the 70s, there was the whole push behind like Uri Geller.
Yes.
And, you know, bringing psychic power out. And the guy behind him was Puharich, this Andrei mm-hmm. Puharich, who seems to have those kinds of connections, which go to, you know, this type of activity, but also the Central Intelligence Agency. Mm-hmm. He's been associated or was associated years before that with a group called the Nine.
Yes.
Which is this channeling circle of mm-hmm. some of the wealthiest people in America, along with some kind of advanced yogi guru type guys who were mm-hmm. channeling this, what was supposed to be these Egyptian gods in a ship off of Earth. What's interesting to me about it is, since we're talking about consciousness affecting things, is that Arthur Young was involved. His wife, Ruth Forbes, was involved. And Young wound up, who's the developer of the helicopter, mm-hmm. he wound up creating these consciousness studies mm-hmm. And all of these different organizations to study consciousness. Mm-hmm. So when I look at that and I think about, okay, but they're in touch with this occult nine aspect, and yet they're working on very practical matters. And of course, we know Bell Helicopter and all the strangeness around that. And actually, Michael Payne is Young's son. Mm-hmm. So you have geopolitical aspects, occult aspects, and kind of almost deep state sorcery.
Yes. I go back to something that Father Malachi Martin said during one of his interviews on Art Bell. He was asked if there was an occult aspect to what we would now call the deep state. And if I recall, his answer was, and I'm paraphrasing badly from memory here, his answer was something like, oh my, yes. You would be surprised at the number of very well-known rich families that at their core are heavily involved in that type of activity. So I'm not surprised at all. What I think we're looking at, especially if you look at the development of modern physics since the dawn of quantum mechanics, the materialistic cosmology has been really upset by these developments, because squatting square in the middle of quantum mechanics is the observer effect. Mm-hmm. In other words, that you cannot, you know, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle in its basic form says you cannot measure the position of an electron at the same time as you measure the momentum. Those are conjugate attributes. You can only measure one or the other. So you, as the scientist, are determining the result of your experiment even before you make the observation by determining what it is you want to observe. Now, magnify that to the macro scale of not just dealing with tiny little particles that are so tiny they're nothing but packets of information. Magnify that to the macro scale, you know, the real world, the physical world that we see and deal with. And you're dealing with Dr. William Tiller in California, this materials science professor that decided to put all this consciousness aspect to the test to see if conscious intention could, without any physical connection to a system, modify that physical system.
Right.
So he set up a series of I talk about this on my website. He set up a series of experiments where he would have a group of people, notice that, a group, agree on a formally specified explicit intention to, let's say, modify the gestation period of fruit flies, or modify the pH or acidity or base levels in a solution. And without exception, he discovered that by adding consciousness as an intention, you could modify the physical system in the prescribed ways within the margins of values that he wanted to be modified. So then he went further, and now we're back to your spinning statue and Dr. Pavlita over in Prague. Then he decided, okay, can we embed that intention in an object, a physical object? And can that object in turn imprint that intention on things within its vicinity? Answer, both are possible.
Incredible.
So in other words, now you've got a material scientist at the University of California, a professor emeritus of the same, in fact, who has basically come out and said, yes, there is an actual science behind the idea, the ancient occult practice of an amulet.
Right.
Or what we would now call a psychotronic object.
Yes.
Yeah. So my point here is that quantum mechanics really opened up a whole new kind of physics where you're going to have to incorporate consciousness as a actual scientific component of study and experimentation in physical systems, because physical systems are not completely physical.
Right.
And here's my favorite term. They're open systems.
So he found the ability to imbue an object with a characteristic.
What?
They impressed upon it, and that is definitely an ancient technology. They could ward off evil with certain types of things and so on. Some of the earliest electrical pieces, yes.
Well, what that's suggesting is, what Tiller's work is suggesting is the extension of the idea that you find the ancient texts when they talk about astrology. The ancient texts tell you that these measurements, these astrological measurements, were taken on the basis of observations taken over thousands of years. In other words, the claim in astrological texts in ancient times is that this was based on an empirical science.
Right.
And what we now call astrology is a declined sort of legacy from that. So what Tiller is suggesting is there was an actual hard science behind all of these occult practices. The occult practices themselves are the decayed legacy of it. So what we have to do is we have to get behind that to set up scientifically experimental rigorous conditions and find out exactly what makes these things work.
Wow.
And what he's saying is, and I know people are going to cringe when I state this, What he found was a group intention that is formally and explicitly elaborated and agreed upon has the ability to alter a physical system.
Amazing.
Now, what he's just told you, I know full well because I've studied theology all of my life.
Right.
Why? Because what's the doctrine of a valid sacrament? A valid sacrament has to have proper form, proper matter, and here it comes, proper intention. The matter of a sacrament is like the bread and wine in communion, or the water of baptism, or the male candidate for holy orders. And note I said male, and so on. The intention, this is the key, the intention are the words that are formally specified for the performance of that sacrament. In other words, the words of the Mass or the Divine Liturgy, which must have certain elements present in it conceptually in order for that sacrament to be valid. So in other words, group intention is expressed sacramentally in the text of the liturgy. Why do you think Mr. Globalone has been so hell-bent on liturgical renewal and changing the text of the Mass or of the liturgy? And why are the churches declining in power? I argue that this is directly tied to Tiller's research, because he's saying exactly the same thing. When you scramble the text, you're scrambling the intention. When you're scrambling the intention, the effect is going to be reduced.
Fascinating.
And disturbing.
Yes. That's unbelievable. Well, I think whenever I think about this part of things, I think about the Sodom and Gomorrah tale story recounting, because there's the whole piece about find me a group of men.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. And he keeps going down a number and keeps going down a number, and he gets to 10.
Yeah.
If you can just find 10, you'll save the whole place.
There's another famous example. When two or three are gathered together in my name, and they do what? They pray. Well, what's the gathering in my name? It's an agreement upon a specified intention.
Right.
Right.
Wow, that is fascinating. And it shows that power also, because if everyone understood that power, then...
Yes.
Yeah, there's a real big reason for keeping that out of their reach.
Out of their reach. Right. There's a big reason for Vatican II. There's a huge reason for Vatican II. There's a huge reason for all the liturgical renewal in the churches. And you find, incidentally, if you look at certain Masonic associations, you'll find controversies among Masons over the change of the text of Masonic ritual. Why? Because again, you're dealing with a group intention here that you want to modify or disempower,
right,
to some degree.
Well, it's amazing. I remember during the whole rollout of all of this stuff associated with the lockdowns and everything else, they wanted to lock those churches down.
Bingo.
They were so hell-bent on it that it became the central thing. Mm-hmm. And it's so fundamental and, of course, locked into the Constitution and everything else. But this, they were absolutely, you know, no group intention.
Right. And let's go further here. If we're talking about these kinds of psychotronic objects and concepts with a formally specified group intention, how else can you modify a textual intention? Well, one way to do it is by the old Gnostic tactic of redefining terms. So if you go back to Daniel Webster, what was one reason that he began to compile his dictionary? Now, I'm an OED person myself, not a Daniel Webster person. But one of the things that he was about was to solidify the meanings of words, because his fear was that they would change the Constitution by changing the meanings of words. So you can have the same word, but if it means something different to you than it means from the group using the word, then the intention changes.
Oh, wow.
This is why Malachi Martin, if you read his books, he spent enormous amount of time in his books talking about the penetration of the Roman Catholic Church by so-called liberation theology, for which terms like Christ or salvation or redemption or Eucharist or whatever had a different meaning to that specific group of people than it had for the rest of the church, because it's the Daniel Webster scenario. They're changing the meaning of a word to create a different intention.
Right. Wow. That's incredible. And of course, you know, when it comes to things like the Constitution,
uh-huh,
you can see that there's a kind of an ironclad thing embedded in it.
Yes.
And there's only certain ways you could unravel it. But we see them trying to limit words all the time.
No, again, Gnosticism is all about language. You signal your assent to a Gnostic agenda or intention by adopting their linguistic agenda. In other words, pronouns are important.
Ah.
It's an attempt to create reality, to influence reality through the manipulation of words, and by the manipulation of words, to the manipulation of intent. So what they're trying to do, it's very, very clever what they're trying to do. They are creating, with all of their agendas, they are creating the breakdown of a cultural group intention. If you look at them, they're waging war on all of the institutions of our culture,
right,
from sex to family, church, religion, materials, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing that, they're breaking down the consensus. And breaking down the consensus means they're breaking down group intention, because they know that there's real power there. Think again of what happened in Poland as the Warsaw Pact began to unravel. How did Poland, tiny little, you know, Poland, under the thumb of a brutal communist dictatorship, unravel it? Well, again, they reversed the whole strategy and concentrated on talking and forming the opinion of Polish society. They weren't a bit interested about controlling the government, controlling the army, controlling the press. They were interested in getting their opinions into the common body of the people and creating a group intent. And once that happened, the government was absolutely powerless to deal with them. And the Polish communist government fell, and the Warsaw Pact unraveled, and the Soviet Union collapsed.
Incredible. That is the power of that group intention.
That's the power of that group intention. Right.
And those are the that's the kind of superpowers that you would try to move an entire culture away from if you were trying to replace it with something else.
Right. That's why Mr. Globaloney is deathly afraid of the churches, is deathly afraid of the mosques, is deathly afraid of the synagogues, because those places are repositories par excellence of group intention. So if they can get rid of that and reshape the group intention in their own agenda, they will have accomplished their goal. That's what's really at stake here. This is a spiritual cultural war. It is not a political one.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, too, because those intentions have been formed over hundreds of thousands of years.
Bingo.
And they want to unravel them rather quickly.
Yeah. Now, I think that unraveling process, I think there's kind of a built-in mechanism in cosmology that prevents complete unraveling. Because if that were to happen, you'd have you'd have no basis of knowing anything. You'd have no epistemology. You'd have no culture. You'd have no society. So at some point, there's always kind of a rubber band moment when everything snaps back, mm-hmm. in spite of all the attempts to meddle with it. I think that's where they're headed. In other words, I'm predicting that Mr. Globaloney, for all of his power, is going to fail, and going to fail colossally because of this fact. Because really what they're trying to do is ultimately not just inhuman, it's anti-human.
Right. So on a certain level, through these machinations, they're going to have to answer.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They may, you know, they may be caught in their own trap. And I can see signs of that happening already, simply because they cannot seem to be capable of thinking in any other way. And they've lost their old guard. You know, the old guard would push, but they would push. And if they got pushback that was too significant, they'd pull away, regroup, and try a different tack to accomplish the same thing. All What's right. missing now, you don't have the David Rockefellers.
All right.
You don't have the Zbigniew Brzezinskis. You've got the Bill Gateses, and you've got the Klaus Schwabs, and they're in a hurry. And they're making colossal mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, that's really, really true.
Mm-hmm.
And the shock and awe approach that they've taken has built into it opposition.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what else would you expect? If you're living in a culture that has been so for at least the last 1,400 years, if not longer, but I would say definitely at least 1,400 years. And for, I would opine, for very specific theological reasons that occurred in the West, if you're dealing with a culture that is used to thinking in a binary way, everything that you do creates an opposition.
Mm-hmm.
These people cannot think in more than two terms at once, and that automatically creates opposition.
Right.
It is inevitable. That's what's happening to them. They're being hoisted on the petard of their own cultural logic.
Interesting. And they're headed for a fall, but again, like the post-war Berlin, things mm-hmm. can get pretty flattened on the ground in the middle of their destruction.
Yep.
Yep. Wow, it's incredible. Joseph, I wanted to mention something to you, and it does jump back to the ancient technology, but mm-hmm. I came across this article, and I know we've talked about mummification before. And you described it as a technology, which I always found fascinating. This just came out, and I'll read it just real quickly. According to a team of researchers, the body of Kuwi, K-H-U-W-Y, shows mummification techniques used 4,000 years ago were much more advanced than previously thought. In particular, mm-hmm. the embalmers bathed the body in resins from tree sap and wrapped it in high-grade bandages, a technique originally thought to have been begun 1,000 years later.
Mm-hmm.
A deep dive into the lost research will occur during this special, and so on. Another piece, the findings could mean a complete re-examination of history's view of the Old Kingdom. Mm-hmm. If this is indeed an Old Kingdom mummy, all books about mummification and history of the Old Kingdom will need to be revised. So you hinted that the mummification came from a legacy culture
mm-hmm.
and that they inherited it, which is why it's so advanced there. And by the time you get to Ptolemy, they don't know what they're doing. They're just like, throw it in there any old way you can. But the art of mummification, the way the Egyptians do it, just the sophistication of pulling the brains out, you know, mm-hmm. and the preserving the heart and so on. What was it that they were expecting from this process of mummification? Were they expecting to be able to reanimate these bodies?
I think, well, maybe reanimation, but I think more they were thinking in terms of resurrection, or to put it in the kind of quasi-occult consciousness physics way of putting things, that they viewed the body, the human body, and literally any body of any living creature, but particularly humans, as a psychotronic device par excellence. Because if you stop and think about it, our bodies, you know, the adage is in the modern world that the body is a prison, that our souls are imprisoned in our body. Mm-hmm. The ancient way of looking at it was very, very different. And I think you could say this probably of Buddhism. Certainly you could say it of traditional Judaism, certainly of traditional Christianity, that the ancient way of looking at things was that your body exists inside of your person, not the other way around. We're not imprisoned in this. This is imprisoned in who we are. And therefore, it's a psychotronic device par excellence. And therefore, it's not something that you escape or discard. It's something that you want to preserve, because by preserving that, you're preserving a connection to that individual, who they really are. So they embalm things, much like we bury people today, because there's some connection between the physical makeup of a person and the spiritual makeup of a person. That's why they're doing it. This is why you have, even as late as the Middle Ages, you find this very strange practice of heart burials. They'll bury people's hearts separately from people. And I think, again, it's also because the ancient view of reason is that reason for the ancients, for a Plato, for an Aristotle, for the Egyptians, for the Babylonians, it's not mere ratiocination. It's not this Cartesian idea that we have of reason now. Reason for them also meant the incorporation of the human emotional life, intuition, passion, so on. And therefore, the heart is as much a part to them of your rational faculty as is the brain. And it's very interesting, because now scientists have discovered that there are resemblances of certain cells in the heart to brain cells.
Wow. You know? That's incredible.
Yeah. So there you are, you know, and then you have all these stories of transplant, people that have received organ transplants picking up on the memories of their donor, you know, which is strange. But again, it's telling us that there's more to the physical body than just the physical. There's an imprinted intentionality and memory and so on associated with every component of our body, because the body exists inside our personhood, so to speak. And we're constantly imprinting on it.
Incredible. That really makes a lot of sense. And I think it's interesting in relation to this discovery also that I have a feeling Egyptology has known this about mummification for a
good time. Yeah, I think so.
And
Egyptology, as far as I'm concerned, is all about preserving the academic chronology.
Yes.
You know, let's be blunt. That's what it's really all about. We don't want a bunch of ancients running around there in their rags and embalming people, knowing what they're doing it for, you know.
Right.
We can't have that. We're the smart ones here.
Your own impression, I mean, this whatever culture it was that left this as a legacy for the Egyptians is remarkable. What, from your own explorations, that, like, that culture's been called Atlantis, but what was that culture at the point that they sort of handed this legacy over to Egypt?
Well, I think I always call it the ancient very high civilization.
You know,
lost in the mists of paleo-ancient history, to be redundant. My own model or operating model has been, okay, we have a cosmic war, we blow everything apart, and our infrastructure is shot, so we've got to preserve something. And we've got to preserve it in such a way that we're encoding a lot of our knowledge that will only make sense to a similarly high civilization.
Right.
This is why those ancient texts read one way to a 17th century Frenchman or an 18th century Frenchman going on an expedition with Napoleon to Egypt, and they read much differently to us now. Our scientific knowledge has advanced so that we can see that, yeah, these people may have been talking about what we're talking about, just using the best language they had available. I think that's particularly clear when you examine some of the ancient texts about the Tower of Babylon, you know, the non-biblical texts that deal with it, because clearly they're trying to describe a physics with the best knowledge and technology and terms that they have available. So that's what you're going to do. So I view these legacy civilizations like the Indus Valley or China, which I think is a huge legacy civilization, or Sumer or Egypt, or for that matter, you know, we've got legacy civilizations in Mesoamerica, that these civilizations are legacy civilizations from that civilization that survived that war and is already in a state of decline and is trying to preserve as much as possible in as quick a fashion, knowing full well that this first generation may not completely understand everything and may indeed over time lose more and more information. We just have to impress on them that this is part of the way that this civilization operated. So it's essential for you folks to preserve this, whether you know what you're preserving or not.
Wow.
That's what I think has happened here. Because you look at these civilizations, Daniel, and the mystery that quackademia, as I like to call it, cannot explain is why did we all of a sudden stop hunting and gathering and all of a sudden decide to domesticate animals, invent mathematics, and be, you know, all of this stuff that just springs up out of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, there has to be a seed to it.
Right.
And that's where academia simply fails. It's creating fables and myths that simply are not true. I think you're seeding a culture here, and that culture could very well have come from off planet. You know, we don't know, but certainly there's enough in the ancient texts, from the Vedas to Babylon to Egypt to the Old Testament to Mesoamerica. In every single case, you have these civilizations telling you, no, we got this from somebody. And in the case of Babylonia, that somebody came down here, you know, lowered kingship from heaven to earth. So in other words, there was an intervention that seeded all of this stuff.
Right. Wow. Absolutely fascinating. When you see those images of what they call the Umu or the fish men, and they're carrying the little bag. And, you know, I talked with Grant Hancock about it, and he said, you know, I've seen it all the way from Yucatan to Egypt to Samaria.
Yep.
What is that imagery, do you feel? What kind of steganography is going on there?
I think you're dealing with the steganography of the people that came down from heaven.
Yeah.
Quite literally. Because you not only find that imagery everywhere, you find the story in some form or fashion in all of those ancient texts. I mean, the seven rishis in the Vedas, the seven gods in Babylonia, and so on and so forth. It's everywhere, and it simply requires decoding. You're dealing with what I think, Daniel, you're dealing with is, like I say, that civilization that went through that war was globally extended. So that's the reason. One reason you have the same imagery popping up everywhere is you're dealing with little shards of that civilization that broke apart when the infrastructure couldn't sustain the global connection. So the only thing sustaining that global connection are two things: the myths and legends themselves, and all of those megalithic structures you find all over the world.
Right.
And they all have one thing in common: astronomy.
Right.
Systems of measure that are not, thank you, quackademia, that are not tied to the human body, but that can be duplicated anywhere on the surface of the planet through geodetically based or astronomically based systems of measure.
Wow.
Such as we have in Babylonia, such as we have in the British Isles with all of those megalithic structures, such as we have in Germany with those megalithic structures, such as we have in India with their temples and so on. Everywhere, the same thing. If you're going to jumpstart civilization, what do? Well, you have to have a system of weights and measures to enable commerce. And those systems of weights and measures cannot differ from spot to spot. And that means you have to have geodetically or astronomically based systems of measure to carry on and conduct commerce and jumpstart things. These people were very smart. Yeah, very smart.
Incredible. And they've left that legacy in, in a thing called, you know, the pyramid, for example.
Yeah.
But we're seeing it, and we have this ability now through LIDAR and other things to be able to see through those jungles and be like, oh, here's a huge,
a huge something.
What I find interesting is, you know, they are finding all these stories about, oh, we have this Mayan temple, but you know what? It's 1,000 years earlier. Uh-huh. It's like, now that's just getting out. And they kept it under wraps for as long as they could until they really mastered where everything was that they wanted to get their hands on in those archaeological wars. But what's interesting to me is that those things have been going on. You know, I mentioned Lindbergh earlier. One of the things he was hired for while he was sort of, you know, setting up these incredible record-breaking flights was to fly over the Yucatan to see what ruins were below. These groups were very interested. Carnegie was very interested in the Egyptian ruins and in dinosaur bones. But they knew that this was a building block. And of course, by the time we get to the Nazis, they really understood the magical right of the magical object.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Here's a question for you.
Yes.
In all of the studies and articles about continuity of government that you've read, have any of them ever addressed the question of, okay, we blow ourselves apart and the infrastructure, how are we going to jumpstart civilization again? Do we know how to create geodetic or astronomically based systems of measure? We don't even navigate our ships anymore.
Wow.
Using celestial navigation.
All right.
Can we do it in our wonderfully sophisticated digital age? Would we know how?
Wow.
My suspicion is probably not.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a reason the Navy's training sailors how to navigate celestially again. Because if you take out those global positioning satellites and you've got your big honking aircraft carrier out in the middle of nowhere and you don't know where you are, how are you going to do it?
Yes. That backup system.
That backup system. The contingency plan better be analog or there ain't nothing for it, folks.
Wow. Excellent point.
Mm-hmm.
You know what that made me think of, and it kind of rounds out everything we're talking about, which is during the digs that they were doing in Nevada to get the AEC going, Atomic Energy Commission, they needed to build these really large-scale tunnels to do experiments in. Mm-hmm. And during that process, they found a very ancient culture beneath Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about that is the structures are very pyramid-like.
Mm-hmm.
And we only got a look at one or two which survived because so many of those things got airbrushed and so on, even the ones that got out. Of course, everything related to the NASA projects, when they go to the moon and all the rest, there was a guy who came forward who his job was to airbrush that stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Hoagland earlier, and there was that really interesting and unusual C-3PO head thing that they used to show in relation to photos on the moon. But what cracks me up about that is that they became aware of it. Uh-huh. And they became aware, you know, just like in digging out these pyramids in Nevada, they knew that there was something far more advanced going on. And that is a real deficit on the part of the culture, that we don't understand that, and that there are ruins on Mars that we've never seen, or there's ruins on the moon. And so now that they've had that knowledge and they've figured out how to work it, and the culture has not gone along with them, they've done it on their own, they can now turn that around and maybe create a false origin story for humanity.
Yes.
Do you think that's where they're going?
I think it's entirely possible, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's a reason for their secrecy. And part of the reason, I think, is exactly what you've just said. They need to develop a historical narrative that is fundamentally different from the kind of historical narrative that alternative researchers have been uncovering. Mm-hmm. I don't put that past them at all. And again, I think their ultimate target here is going to be that cultural memory, that group intention that comes out of all of these ancient cultures, because there's an amazing amount of parallel in all of them. If you really stop and look at them with open eyes, they're going to try to get rid of that through reshaping the historical narrative. There's no doubt in my mind, because we already see them in a certain way, Daniel, in my opinion, trying to prep that narrative with all of this sudden government admission after years of denial. Oh, yeah, maybe E.T., maybe somebody else, maybe there's some stuff up there, maybe there isn't, you know. Mm-hmm. Let's go look. They're prepping a narrative here. Just like all the preparation for the COVID narrative, you go back and look at the studies and stuff, they were prepping this thing for a long time. That's exactly what I see them doing now. They're going to try and tinker with historical memory. They're not going to be successful, because again, they have to fundamentally alter mankind himself in toto. Mm-hmm. Let there be one exception out there, and the narrative collapses. Let there be one black swan that's not going along with the narrative, and it collapses.
Wow. Absolutely fascinating. Joseph, incredible information on this. I have to ask, if you're looking over the horizon next year and thinking about what your next book will be.
I'm kind of in a holding pattern right now. I had a bunch of books lined up. I was actually working on one on a very dark subject, and then Biden and Co. got elected. Mm. And, you know, I'm not stupid. I believe painting a big target on oneself is a very unhealthy exercise. So I've kind of tabled some of the projects. If there is another book, it might be on a few different subjects next year. One of them may be Gnosticism. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I haven't got any solid plans as of yet. I'm just kind of, pardon me, in a holding pattern. And part of that's because the website has grown so much, it's very difficult for me even to find time during the day to practice, much less write a book. I'm very serious.
Yes.
The website, as you know, is taking more and more and more of my time.
Oh, yeah.
But I do plan to write. It's just a matter of finding the right subject, inspiration, and stuff. One person told me I need to write a history of the Templars, and that would be a very good topic to do. But the problem is, for me to do the job I want to do, I would have to have access to the state archives of Venice.
Right.
And I would have to know how to read medieval Italian script, you know, to do the job I want to do and verify some hypotheses I've already put out there. But that's the other problem, is finding the research material. It's becoming increasingly difficult, as you know.
Yes.
To do that.
That's incredible. You have this incredible library of works that you've put out for the public, and all the way, the one that I've been reading recently goes back to the Reich of the Black Sun, and you
no
have
occult connections there.
The celestial swastika and other SS connections. This is a remarkable book, and I highly recommend that along with so many of your books. But I think you've left so many of these. You presented these questions before the public, and you've informed them on levels. So now they're better educated, and now they're left with the curiosity of, you know, how do they interpret this world based on the information that they have? They're far more informed, but it is an interesting question because everything that they're getting fed on a mainstream level is manipulated in some fashion to get them thinking in a particular way. Mm-hmm. So now they have the tools. And I think that what happens is, you know, it is an interesting position that you get put into, which is they look forward to your next work because they want to know how do you navigate this environment.
That's the difficulty. I'm constantly being asked, when's the next book out? And like I say, if there is one subject that people seem to be focused on, it's what I mean by Gnosticism. Mm-hmm. So I have been thinking about doing a book on that, going all the way back and dealing with the religious version and then carrying it forward and dealing with people like Herbert Marcuse and the Frankfurt School and Theodor Adorno, you know, people that most people haven't heard of, or Jacques Derrida and the so-called deconstructionists. You know, there's lots of fuel for it, but that's going to require a long book, and it's also going to require me to repurchase about $1,000 worth of patristics texts to show people how all of this kind of morphs over time. But it's basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. But also to deal with those areas and places where dissent has unraveled that narrative. You know, Poland again, targeted, and not by accident that it was Poland. You know, it's a predominantly Roman Catholic country, and the Roman Church inside of Poland, even under the communists, was still very traditionally Roman Catholic and still very powerful.
Right.
And it, you know, they made a deliberate targeting of the culture and of the society. Just forget the government. Let them have their tanks and, you know, their missiles and all that. And pretty soon, you know, they were left without the people. The government simply collapsed. And we're seeing that in this country right now. We're seeing the same phenomenon. The people are just rejecting this misadministration in droves. You know, think, let's go, Brandon. And, you know, at some point when you lose the people, the government collapses. And, you know, we don't have a good mechanism under our current constitutional system of government for that kind of collapse. You know, if this were a parliamentary government, Biden would be gone by now.
Yes.
You know, this is what we're saddled with under this current system. Me being an anti-federalist, I would be perfectly willing to entertain a parliamentary system of there's no reason we should be stuck with a grifting, demented failure of a president like this one. There's no reason we should be stuck with a Gavin Newsom forever and ever and ever. You know, I'm all for recalls or parliamentary at the federal level. This current system is not working out too well. But anyway, that's just me.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, I don't think we've ever had a 10 months open for a president like this. This has been just, I mean, it's incredible. It is. Here's an idea for you.
This
fire 1,000 healthcare workers and replace them with the National Guard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We don't need those doctors and nurses. You know, I wish they'd say the same about the lawyers, but anyway. it's just when you look at it and look at this misadministration, it's beginning to make the administration of Buchanan look good. Which was up till now was universally believed and reviled as the worst administration ever. But no more, folks. Joe Biden has gone way past that. Jeez.
You get some four-star officers like Rachel Levine going,
Come on, please.
China's shaking in their boots.
You know, yeah, you talk about war on women.
Yes. Yeah. Tell it like it is.
Yeah. You know, this.
They reintroduced segregation.
Yes. I mean, it's beyond the pale. You know, Daniel, I have nothing but frustration and anger when I think of this misadministration. It's just unbelievable. And this man cannot even read a teleprompter without stumbling.
Oh my God.
You know, I really do. I go back to what I said earlier. I really think they're building that wall around his house to imprison him.
This is fascinating. Yeah. The more we think about it, the truer it gets.
I mean, Trump and his tweets was nothing like this. He's ending up making Trump tweets look good. You know? How is this possible? Unreal. It's just unreal.
This is quite a period.
That it is.
In. Yeah. It's unprecedented.
And you know, if you're a Vladimir Putin or a Xi Jinping and you're looking at this mess, the only thing I can think of is they're, you know, when they get back to their private apartments in the Kremlin or the Forbidden City or wherever they're, you know, they're hanging out, that they are probably laughing themselves to sleep. It couldn't be better for them. You know? I mean, he closes down the energy industry, and so now we're buying oil from Russia. But gotta beware of those dang Russians. They're behind everything, don't you know? So let's give them lots of money for oil. You know? Oh God, that's unreal.
That's fascinating. Unreal.
You know, there's so many ways that this falls apart that it's not funny, and yet they keep pushing. And it's because, again, I go back to something I said to George Ann Hughes, decade or more ago. These people have surrounded themselves, Mr. Globalone has surrounded himself with people of exactly the same philosophy for so long that they cannot think in any other way. They're incapable of thinking outside their own box. And this is the leadership elite that we're supposed to follow?
Right.
What's happening is they're creating a whole class now of people who do not trust anything that they or the government say.
Yes.
And they're going out and they're creating their own networks and doing things for themselves. That's a big bad thing for you know, an all competent Biden administration government to have happen to it, because you're losing the people again.
Right.
It's, you know, so we're looking at some very interesting times, and it's just getting started.
Those domestic terrorists.
Yeah. How dare they confront their school board about the critical race theory and come on, you know, if this government has gone to that extreme, it's not going to be around much longer. It really isn't. People are just not going to go for it. They're just not going to go for it. So maybe, you know, maybe my scenario is right. They're deliberately trying to provoke a crack up. I don't know.
Right. The push when it crashes, it's pretty ugly.
Yes. Yeah. It is. It's an ugly scenario any way you slice it.
Amazing.
You know, we're in for some tough, rough times. But I think the good thing is we're seeing enough signs of enough pushback on this whole thing all over the world. Mm-hmm. You know, the protests in Australia are not even being covered.
Right.
And they're massive.
Yeah.
They're massive. And it's going to get much worse. It's going to get much worse. But the good thing is people will start to band together. And we're seeing it. We're seeing it. Before we go, did you ever think that you'd be in this position now in this country, even with Biden and Co?
No.
No, I didn't either. You know, I'm grateful my parents have passed. You know, my dad saw this coming decades ago, but I'm grateful that they passed, because they wouldn't recognize this.
My God.
they wouldn't recognize this. And they were Democrats.
But the real Democrats would never have put up with this.
No, not in a million years. Truman?
Wow.
No. No.
Kennedy? I mean,
Kennedy, no. It's just, it boggles the mind. It really does. I'm, you know, this is not the USA that I remember from, you know, even 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's just a very short period
of things unraveling so quickly.
Oh my God! Yeah,
yeah.
It's just, and yet you projected a lot in your own work of things that were coming up, and I think that what's fascinating is when you read some of the breakaway civilization books that you have, they're eerily prescient about the period that we're moving into in 2022. Especially on the UAP UFO thing.
Yeah, the breakaways are trying to take over. They're trying to step out into the open, if you look at it a certain way. And, you know, basically what we're seeing is a federal government that's been captured by a group of radicals that have no connection to the history or culture of this country, much less Europe. And people are rejecting it out of hand, and good for them. You know, more power to them. Keep doing it. We need a lot more.
We do.
Yeah, we do.
It has to become a whole movement of people to push back against that, because that's just the most basic freedom is being challenged.
Yep. Think Poland.
Yes.
Think Poland.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, they were successful. We need to remember that. Mr. Globaloney and his communist counterparts had all the power, all the institutions, all the press, all the military, all the police, everything, and collapsed.
Wow.
Because the polls said no.
Incredible example.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. That's great to see you, sir.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me back.
Joseph, absolutely fascinating. Of course, your remarkable work can be found at GizaDeathStar.com, and we'll definitely have you back real soon. Please join us next Friday for a new episode of the X Series. Watch your Dark Journalist newsletter for some special guests coming up here this winter. See you soon.